Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. Today, I will be your host, Tanner, joined by my co-host, Taylor. Say hello to everyone, Taylor.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? It's fun to let Tanner take the wheel. I think we'll start doing this more and more. We'll probably start alternating weeks, so I will do one, and then he will do one. That's kind of the new thing we want to do.
I guess take the helm. Would that be the more appropriate?
Yeah. That would be the more appropriate way of saying that, I suppose.
So anyway, we are here on another episode of Beyond the Breakers. We have some big news here in Breaker Land. This past week, we passed 1,000 downloads for the show.
Yeah, it was exciting. And then we promptly passed 1,100 downloads. So thank you, everybody.
Yeah, like that was, we had a really, really great week of downloads. And we are just over the moon with how the show has been doing, how many people are listening to it and interacting with the show. So in order to sort of celebrate that, we'd like to do a kind of different episode. We'd like to do a primarily Q&A episode. I know I posted about this on Instagram. I know Taylor posted about it on the Breakers Instagram. We'd like to do a Q&A episode if we can get enough Qs to warrant our A's. or just kind of also kind of a general recap episode, just kind of look back on what we've, I guess, learned doing the show so far. So we want to do something a little bit different there. So yeah, get us those questions. We are on Twitter at @beyond_breakers. We're on Instagram at @beyondthebreakerspodcast. Our email is beyondthebreakerspod@gmail.com. You can find me on Instagram. I think if you just search by name, but also hive.fleet.hodag. So all of those ways, any way you want to get us those questions is awesome. We'd be happy to answer questions about the show, you know, specific episodes, the show in general, other stuff, life in general.
Just don't be weird. We won't answer the weird ones.
No weird questions, preferably. But aside from that, yeah, anything is fair game. In addition to that, there is, of course, we have a Patreon. Patreon.com/beyondthebreakers. We will always make the show ad free. We have no desire to read ads to you or play ads to you. Money from the Patreon goes back into making the show. There is, you know, some amount of research we have to do for this, and then also production costs for sharing the show with everyone. There are two different tiers on Patreon. There's a $3 tier, which gets you also early access to episodes. And the $5 tier, which is early access plus some bonus content each month. We're always thinking of new ways to make good new bonus content. So we'll try to keep that coming out for everyone.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So I think that covers our intro here. So in this episode, we actually are going to take a trip to a new continent we haven't been to before on the show. We are going to Africa.
Nice.
And specifically, we're going to Tanzania.
Okay.
And more specifically, we are going to focus on Lake Victoria.
Interesting. It's always nice to get a new body of water to do a shipwreck in.
For sure. Yeah, we've done a couple in Lake Michigan. We've done some in the Atlantic. But it's nice to get something new and branch out a little bit. So
I guess first and foremost, when you hear lake, I know a lot of people think of, you know, something fairly small. That's not what we're dealing with here, right? This is more Great Lakes-esque. I think it'll be a good comparison for most people, right?
For sure. And I think, you know, people from the upper Midwest, people in the Great Lakes region, maybe have a different sense of this word lake. You know, to us, it kind of does mean something that might be quite large. I do think that to some people, when they hear this word lake, there's this idea that It's something that maybe you can see across. And right. This is,
I think, especially down south in the United States, where you have a lot of the rivers that were impounded to create lakes. You think of like where you go like water skiing or take, you know, pontoon boats out and stuff like that. This isn't that kind of lake.
Exactly. This is a massive, massive body of water. Lake Victoria is the largest lake in Africa, and it's one of the largest lakes in the world. A approximate area of 27,000 square miles.
Dang, that's a big lake.
That's about 70,000 kilometers per hour, kilometer people. for comparison, that is number three in the world, behind only the Caspian Sea and Lake Superior.
Big lake.
Very big lake. Second largest freshwater lake. Caspian Sea, I guess maybe we could argue, is that really a lake, or does that need a different, a different category?
Yeah, I feel like you're getting into semantics at that point.
Yeah. Anyway, a lot of water. This is a massive, massive body of water. So Lake Victoria is shared by Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. Uganda and Tanzania account for about 90% of the shoreline of Lake Victoria. On Lake Victoria, there are several main ports on the shoreline that serve as really important transportation routes for the area. One in particular that we'll talk about in this episode is the port city of Mwanza in Tanzania. Okay. That'll be
important. And that's at the south side of the lake, essentially.
Yeah, that's basically on the south side of the lake. We'll be talking primarily about the southwestern part of Lake Victoria. Okay. Some of these other ports around the lake, again, there are several. One of them that might possibly ring a bell for listeners is Entebbe, Uganda.
Okay.
Which is, I think, most famous, at least in the West, for the IDF commando raid at its airport in 1976.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. I have heard of that before, mm-hmm. actually.
Actually, interesting fact about that. The raid, you know, being conducted by the IDF, Benjamin Netanyahu's older brother, Jonathan, was killed in that raid. He was the IDF unit commander, and he may have been the only IDF casualty.
Really?
But anyway, there's an interesting fact for us today here. So back to our story. So Lake Victoria, again, big body of water shared by multiple countries. This is a huge transportation route. It's commonly traversed by a lot of different types of vessels, many of which fall under the ro-ro classification that we've talked about on several episodes at this point.
Right. Yes, we have.
So we're relatively familiar with the ro-ro ships.
I think it's also worth pointing out, like, you know, you kind of mentioned it, but this is like an extremely important transportation route because mm-hmm. there's not the road networks and everything around the lake aren't the best. There's no interstate system and all that. Like, if you're moving goods and people, this body of water is a huge way to do it.
Yeah, I think that for me, especially, like, kind of thinking of Lake Victoria before researching this, I kind of thought of it in a, I guess, more of like an Attenborough documentary sense of, oh, this is a lot of majestic wildlife and this is a beautiful geographic feature. But it's also like a highway.
Right.
And that's where it comes into our episode. So yeah, both passenger travel and cargo transport happens on this lake. And that brings us to the main character of our show today, the ferry Bukoba. So, Bukoba was a ferry that ran a regular route between its namesake, the port of Bukoba, and the city of Mwanza, or town of Mwanza. So this is a route across the southwestern portion of Lake Victoria. The ferry that we're talking about today, the Bukoba, had a listed capacity of 430 passengers and 850 tons of cargo.
Dare I say those numbers will be important later?
Yeah, remember those numbers, because we'll talk about those a little bit more. Specifically, the passengers. So the ship entered service in 1979, and it was owned and operated by the state-run Tanzania Railways Corporation. Later in the episode, I'll be referring to the same corporation as TRC. So anytime you hear TRC, that's Tanzania Railways Corporation. So unlike some of our stories that we do on the show, we'll kind of be diving right into the incident itself. So it's running this regular route. However, on the morning of May 21st, 1996, at about 7:30 in the morning, the Bukoba was about 30 miles from the port of Mwanza on the southern shore of Lake Victoria. Initial reports about what exactly happened are a little bit conflicting, but it's clear that whatever happened, the ship capsized very quickly once it ran into trouble. Mm-hmm. Some of the people who were able to escape, they reported that it had struck a rock, which caused the accident.
Interesting.
This was pretty quickly refuted by the TRC acting deputy managing director, PJ Kiesi, denying that it had hit a rock. Other people attributed the ship's capsizing to the fact that it was really, really, really extremely overloaded. So this also was initially denied by the government transport ministry. They claimed it was carrying its legal capacity of 433 people.
I think one thing that's interesting, it kind of points out why like eyewitness testimony, especially of non-experts, is generally unreliable. Mm-hmm. But things like the ship hit a rock, like it probably shifted and it felt like you hit something, but that mm-hmm. was never the case. Like they were still mid-lake when this happened. So like there's no rocks to hit.
Yeah, this is interesting because it's the kind of phenomenon that you talk about in like any like introductory psychology course about how, you know, eyewitness things can have radically different testimonies. And you kind of see that here. This never really comes up again. In all of the sources I read that came out, you know, more than a day or two after the accident, none of them mentioned the ship striking anything. So like you said, things can shift around. Maybe it felt like you hit something. And I think to a passenger on the ship, that's probably a logical conclusion.
Right.
So there's that. And then there's also the issue of overloading, which, of course, we're also saying, no, that wasn't the case either, according to the transport ministry. So the ship capsizes relatively quickly. But like we said, this is a heavily trafficked area. So somewhat fortunately, there's several vessels on site pretty quickly. From one report that I read, there were two Ugandan vessels that saw this happen. So they can almost immediately, you know, come and try to render aid. Mm-hmm. So among those, the Ugandan ship Butiama, which sailed out of Entebbe, the ship Clarence, and the Victoria, another Tanzanian ship. This was the largest ship in the Lake Victoria fleet. So all these ships are coming to try and rescue people from the water when they see this accident happen. At this point, the story kind of breaks down and becomes a mess from a numbers perspective. Mm-hmm. So as we just mentioned here, there's these reports that the ferry is dangerously overloaded. This was not really a new thing. This would not have been a unique incident for these Lake Victoria ferries. Standard practice was that the passenger manifests on these ships only recorded passengers in first and second class.
Interesting.
Leaving the third class numbers almost impossible to really ascertain exactly here. Those third class tickets are obviously cheaper. There's going to be more people buying those tickets. So really, we're looking at upwards of double whatever the listed number of people on this ship is.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that the third class isn't really like, it's almost, they're almost viewed more as cargo than like passengers.
Yeah.
Like, you can cram more of them in there. Great. Like that's more money.
Yeah. It really only matters how much they weigh in a sense, not who they are.
Right. So, yeah, so it's much. Very interesting.
So yeah, definitely see the difference in that as we've talked about before, or like in the movie Titanic. No, the
yeah.
So yeah, you're looking at. Go ahead.
I was also going to say, it kind of reminds me of Lady Elgin a little bit, where they don't have a good manifest, because, mm-hmm. I mean, you have the same thing there of, you know, when they run out of people that are paying for tickets to go to that excursion, like, they start just handing them out mm-hmm. to people. So you end up with a scenario where you don't even have, like, a name for everyone that's on board.
Right.
So when this happens, that's where you get these different body counts, and, like, you don't really know how bad the tragedy it actually is mm-hmm. until later.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, it's really about filling space and you know, selling tickets, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So one survivor, Irafto Kinubi, who was 36 at the time, he was quoted by the Irish Times as follows. So I have a relatively long quote here to read. I think there were around 900 or 1,000 on board. I went to where the life jackets were, but there were too many people fighting, and there weren't enough jackets anyway. Then there was another wave, and the ship flipped upside down. I was thrown clear. I said my last prayers. I was ready to die, and then I saw a life jacket floating past. I caught it, struggled into it, and held on to a floating ring until I was rescued. So this same survivor, he also states, the ship was hit by waves and rolled to one side and overturned quickly. So this testimony kind of supports the idea that the ferry was overloaded. It's not able to stay upright in water that is never really described as being rough. Like, this isn't bad weather. These aren't big waves. But the ship is so overloaded and unstable that it can't handle the kind of standard waves that the lake is giving it.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of, like, Katmai, where it's so overloaded that in that case, like, it was stormy, but it wasn't something that should have sank that ship.
Mm-hmm.
But because of being overloaded, the ship didn't act in the normal ways that you would expect it to.
Mm-hmm. So by the end of the day, so by the end of May 21st, 120 survivors had been pulled from the lake and 25 bodies had been recovered. Local media on scene, they estimated the death toll at 500. The TRC officials gave their estimate at a more conservative 300.
That's a convenient number.
It is a convenient number, because if you look at the math there, if you're saying this ship was officially at capacity about 430, we rescued 120 people, so there must be only 300 people dead. It's very convenient math, right off the bat there. So all things considered, one thing that we do know is that a relatively small number of people were able to make it off the ship. If the higher estimates of the death toll are to be believed, only about 10% of the people aboard were able to get off.
Which I would imagine those are the people who were lucky and just happened to be on, you know, one of the top decks when this event happened.
Yeah, like as we just talked about with that survivor, I've lost his name here, Irafto Kinubi, saying he was basically thrown clear of the vessel, and he basically only survived by chance because a life vest happened to float past him.
I think that reminds me of, like, the Sewell, where, like, smoking saved some people's lives.
Exactly.
They happened to be on the top deck smoking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being thrown clear of this wreck was the best thing that could have happened to you.
Yeah, especially in a situation where the conditions are fairly, you know, nice. There's a lot of vessels around. I think that's one of the more tragic things in this story. There's so many vessels around that can save people, but they don't even really get a lot of opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, a lot of parallels in this story with the Sewol that we talked about in South Korea. So the rescue efforts, they continue, like, the next day also. You've got Army, Navy, police, even Red Cross personnel arrive fairly quickly on the scene. Not meeting great success. Not a lot of survivors are pulled from the water after the initial group. So one source, I will mention this, This, I believe, came from the Irish Times source that I was reading. Quote, passengers who had not drowned still risked attack by crocodiles and hippopotamuses, which abound in the 27,000 square kilometer. That should be mile. Square mile lake. Just, I guess, as a note here, I'll kind of point out a difference that I noticed in Western reporting versus local reporting on this tragedy and other types of tragedies like this. Explicitly mentioning the crocodiles and hippopotamuses, I never see that in the local sources. Of course, mm-hmm. that's more probably part of life for people that live around Lake Victoria. But it strikes me as a bit of sort of intentional sensationalism a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Of, oh, not only like the ferry itself sinking is not interesting enough. We need to add some more drama to make people read this story.
Yeah. And I think it's also like anytime, I mean, I don't think nowadays we write articles that say like the crew was in shark infested waters. It's like the sharks just live in the ocean. That's where they belong.
That's their home. If anything, the waters are human infested.
Right. Yeah. And the fact that there's zero reports from being attacked by a crocodile or a hippo.
Yeah. Because it came up in multiple like of the articles, I wanted to mention it, but I couldn't find any local confirmed sources that said victims of this tragedy were also subject to attacks by crocodiles and hippopotamuses.
It's also 1996. There's like the internet's still in its infancy. Like, it's still kind of mystical, you know what I mean? Like Africa, Lake Victoria, like you still sort of have that mindset going into it. So
yeah,
it probably helps sell a newspaper to tell a story about a hippo infested, you know, lake.
And again, not arguing that it didn't happen, because of course that's possible. But it's not something I saw listed as any significant factor in this story. So.
While we're talking about news articles, I actually found one this morning when I was doing a little extra research here. There's a story of, this is from the LA Times in 1996. There's a story here of an African businessman who apparently was in an air pocket mm-hmm. when the vessel overturned. And he wrote a note, actually, and that it was found on his body later. Mm. And he says that we sealed the door with bed sheets and the only thing we need is oxygen. We lived until the 23rd, but we are finished. So there's people alive when this vessel's overturned. Like that's how bad of a situation we're dealing with people not being able to get off the vessel. That is an unpleasant way to go.
That's a pretty that's a pretty devastating story there.
That kind of reminds me of a lot of like the submarine accidents and stuff, like the Kursk or something, where you see like, you know, if you weren't killed in the initial incident, you wait 2 or 3 days to run out of oxygen. That's not great.
Right.
Yeah, I just thought that was interesting that, like, that's a thing. That's a thing that happened in this. And I feel like nowadays they're probably more of an attempt to try to go rescue, but I don't know what capabilities they had to even do that, mm-hmm. you know, what kind of danger you've been putting divers in to go do that in this scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely talk about the diving situation in a few minutes here. Let's see. So by the 23rd, so state officials increased their estimate to about 522. So, you know, even they were acknowledging that, yes, more people died on this than we originally claimed. So among the dead, a significant number of secondary school children who were returning home at the end of a school term.
Mm-hmm.
A church choir of 20. Two Ugandan Catholic priests. And I don't even know how to describe this. This was one of those details of this when it jumped out at me. I had to read this like 3 or 4 times to make sure I was reading this correctly. Among the dead, Abu Ubaida al-Banshiri, age 46, birth name Ali Amin Ali al-Rashidi. Now, if that name is unfamiliar, al-Banshiri is one of the co-founders of al-Qaeda, and at the time of his death, he was the second in command of the entire organization. So this person, he had operational control of al-Qaeda in Africa. He was hugely responsible for the spread of its operations in Africa. Really, as far as people go, this person has a really interesting story. He's worth reading about. Fighting obviously, against the Soviets with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, being really, really close confidants with Osama bin Laden, but then also the fact that he was just generally widely respected and very well liked among various different factions of these types of people. He even worked really closely with Ahmad Shah Massoud in Afghanistan. So if you don't know the story of Ahmad Shah Massoud, definitely worth reading about. But yeah, it was just one of those just very odd details of this story. You know, a lot of times the passengers on these are largely faceless, but this was one that definitely had an international presence. And it's just very, I guess, coincidental that he happened to be on the ship.
Congrats to the Tanzanian Railway Company for doing what the CIA couldn't.
Yeah, I guess. So that's an interesting part of this. There was a source that claimed al-Banshiri was in the area trying to compile materials for a dirty bomb, but this appears to be uncorroborated. He owned land around Mwanza, so it's quite possible that this was just a personal trip.
Right.
So anyway, that's a detail of this story that I wasn't expecting when I went into it.
No, definitely not.
Among the survivors, the captain. Ruben Rumé.
It's always a little suspicious when 90% of the people on board a vessel don't survive, but the captain does.
Yeah, that's definitely an outlier compared to some of our stories. So most of those who did survive were treated for injuries, including the captain. It was a very, 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 very small number of people escaped this unharmed. People who do get out are injured in some way. So of the people that are there, a lot of them have to go to the hospital. On May 22nd, so this is the day after, Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa went on the radio to address the accident. He said, quote, "This is not an ordinary tragedy. It is a national tragedy." So he announced 3 days of official mourning in honor of this this tragedy. So we talked a little bit about divers and diving capability earlier. Mm-hmm. If our listeners, if you remember the Sewell episode, we talked about how a lot of the diving efforts were somewhat ad hoc and done by, primarily civilians, because there just weren't government resources to do it. And that, all of the issues involved with that. So in this situation, the divers that do go down on this vessel are the first to confirm that there's as many as 1,000 people on this vessel, possibly more. At this point, the official numbers are still saying there's 300 to 500 people on board. Divers go down and they say, no, there's way more than that. We're looking at 1,000 people dead on this.
God, can you imagine being one of those divers? They're like, that's just like a recipe for PTSD. Mm-hmm. They'd be doing like a stressful, dangerous job. And the ship, you can just tell that there's a thousand people dead at least, or that were on board the vessel just by the number of bodies that you're finding. Mm-hmm. Like, that is an unpleasant job, even if you're, trained to do that job, much less if you're just a civilian diver.
Yeah, for sure. So, again, shades of Sewol here. The efforts at salvage and retrieval, these are actually done largely by outside personnel. So, at the time, Tanzania only has 7 trained divers, or at least 7 available for this, and only 12 oxygen tanks.
Really?
Each tank had about 1 hour of oxygen with no equipment for refilling them. So you've got to you've got to divide 12 hours of oxygen among 7 divers, and that's it, if you're doing this all in-house.
Well, and what I was reading in that LA Times article, they could only spend about 15 to 20 minutes actually on the wreck mm-hmm. by the time you got down to it. So you're talking minimal time. Mm-hmm. actually like on scene.
Yeah. So fortunately there was a lot of collaboration with other countries. So some foreign teams arrived from Kenya and from South Africa to assist in this effort. So they were able to get down there and do some more thorough investigating.
Well, and I would imagine too that like the passengers were not just Tanzanian. Like I imagine that there were a lot of Ugandans and Kenyans and even people from like Burundi and Rwanda that were on board this vessel.
Yeah, this was actually this is an interesting part of doing the research is, you know, going into this, I knew very, very little about Tanzania or this part of Africa as a whole. But there really is a lot of interaction and collaboration amongst these countries, you know, these formerly British colonized countries of Uganda and Kenya and Tanzania. There is a lot of collaboration. So, of course, many of the people on these vessels were from these different countries. So you do see that collaboration in the rescue and the salvage efforts also, which is interesting because you don't always see that with situations like this. Like with Sewol, we saw South Korea refusing a lot of international aid when it was offered. Mm-hmm. But here we basically have, you know, yes, send everyone, you know, we can use all of the help we can get. So that is essentially the story of the sinking of the Bukoba and the immediate aftermath. So let's talk a little bit about why did the Bukoba sink?
Okay.
So to really tell the story of the Bukoba, it's really necessary to see this in a larger context of other similar accidents that have happened since then. There were some accidents before then, but this is kind of the first in a relatively long line of these types of accidents in this part of Africa.
In the research, I was really surprised to see how recent some of these were.
Mm-hmm. In April of 1994, so this would have been before our story, the Mtongwe, a Kenyan vessel, sank, killing 270. We've got the Bukoba, of course, in 1994, where we have anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people dead. Another one we have here is the Spice Islander, which is a ferry that sank in Zanzibar in 2011. This one is of interest because actually, originally, this episode was going to be about the Spice Islander. I think when I texted you about my idea for this episode, that's the vessel that I named that I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
That one sank with a government estimate of 1,500 dead.
Yeah, that's not good when it's 1,500 and it's an estimate. You're just literally saying you don't know.
This is a similar type vessel to what we've talked about with Bukoba. Another Zanzibar ferry, Skagit, sank in 2012 with 150 dead. And another Lake Victoria ferry, the Nyerere, sank in 2018, killing 221.
So I think what's like fascinating about this is like two of those that you listed, the Spice Islander and the Bukoba, both of those would get put into like some of the all-time highest death tolls of shipwrecks.
Mm-hmm.
And they happened relatively close to each other in relatively modern times.
Mm-hmm. And
it's crazy.
And got relatively little coverage.
Yeah, honestly, they did. Like I have heard of both of these, but I didn't know a lot about them before researching any of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this really highlights the disparity in how things are covered. Certainly in, you know, Western media outlets, something that would be a historic tragedy, had it happened, you know, in England or the United States, is, you know, a 1 or 2 day news story at best, when it happens in a place like this. A major challenge while researching this episode was just choosing one, like choosing something to focus on.
Right.
Because I kept sort of getting drawn in different directions of, you know, this one is like this one. There are comparisons to this other accident, this other tragedy. It was kind of difficult to pick one to focus on. Among all of these incidents, there are some common themes. Some of these include poor oversight, a lack of maintenance, and a failure to adhere to capacity limits. A passenger who survived Bukoba reported that quote, there was no proper procedure for ticketing. The ship may have left its initial port of Bukoba at legal capacity, but more passengers reportedly forced their way on during one of its cargo stops at Komondo Bay.
Interesting what they mean by force their way on.
Yeah, and I guess it highlights some of the issues with enforcing these things. If there's really no personnel or capability of enforcing these rules, then they don't, I guess, matter that much.
Well, not only that, I mean, if you're like the guy that's in charge of one of the entries into the ship, but like there's no tickets to sell, but like what stops someone who really wants to get on from giving you $10 or $15 to be like, I really need to get on the ship.
Yeah.
Like I need to go do whatever it is I need to do.
Yeah, for sure. In addition to the capacity issues, this accident really raised awareness that the age of all of these ships was really becoming a problem. Mm-hmm. So some TRC officials said that the Bukoba was due to be taken out of service very soon. This reminded me of the story of El Faro, which was also in a class of ships that was aging, deteriorating, due to be taken out of service and replaced, but just trying to get that one last run out of it, basically.
Right.
A spokesman for the president said that the ferry did pass stability tests that had been undertaken, but that is sort of somewhat nullified by this testimony. Probably the most damning testimony in the aftermath of the incident comes from this Kenyan ship captain named Joseph Mukuti, someone familiar with Lake Victoria and these types of vessels. So he wrote an article in the Daily Nation, a Kenyan newspaper, where he basically listed all of the issues these ships have. He said, "Ferries on the lake flout safety regulations with great impunity. Ships don't have life jackets for those on board. They don't carry life rafts. They don't carry lifeboats, nor do they have enough firefighting equipment on board in case of a fire outbreak. In case of disasters, they have no sound signals or distress signals. They don't undergo mandatory dry docking every 18 months, nor do they have their equipment regularly checked." Quote, "One wonders how they obtain their seaworthiness licenses without the safety equipment." End quote. So obviously calling out some specifics and then, you know, maybe implying that there's some shady dealings going on with how these ships are being certified.
It definitely sounds like it.
he proposed that life jackets should be given to passengers as they board, basically saying this keeps everyone safe. And if no one without a life jacket is permitted on board, this also handles the overloading issue.
I like that idea, especially in like a more dangerous area like this, where clearly the maintenance and the regulations aren't there. But like, can you imagine getting on a boat and being like handed a life jacket right away? Like, here you go.
Yeah,
you might need this.
Yeah, it's not
like, psychologically that would probably not be the best, and there's no way the businesses would do it.
It doesn't exude confidence. Yeah.
No. It does not.
On a bigger scale, he proposed that marine departments in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda should be autonomous and managed by marine officers rather than being managed by politicians and people with no experience of these things.
Probably. That would be a good solution.
It's pretty logical solution. He gave the example of how a Tanzanian captain had been fired from his job for refusing to sail an unseaworthy vessel, just as a way to point out how non-marine, you know, people with no experience in these situations or with these vessels are making these decisions, you know, by looking at a piece of paper or, you know, looking at a computer screen with no knowledge of how a ship should run and what it needs. So as I mentioned before, these ferry problems continued long after Bukoba. In 2011, Somava Mitra, writing for The Guardian, in the aftermath of that Spice Islander disaster, I'm going to quote from him relatively extensively here. He said, quote, "For those who do use ferries, like the people who perished at the weekend, the sleek catamarans which take tourists to the islands of Zanzibar are unaffordable. For most, this means taking night boats, which are cheaper because they're slower than the expensive boats carrying tourists by daylight and, fatally, as it turned out, more prone to overloading. Among the islanders, there's a feeling of inevitability. These outdated ferries will often break down en route, and while complaints are often made, the government says there's no funds to update the fleet. In the absence of government investment, private shipping companies running the expensive ferries prefer tourists, who pay around £30, while those on the Spice Islander would have paid around £2 for their journey.
That's very interesting. Like, kind of just seeing the difference in, like, ticket cost and everything, and how catered to tourists it all is.
Yeah, it's like the location. I mean, still Tanzania, but we're dealing with the Zanzibar coast here. That's different, but the situation's really the same. You've got vessels that benefit from having more and more and more people on them because they're paying these lower fares, and there's really no regulation on how many people are coming on these ships.
Interesting.
The most recent update to the situation that I could find was an article from 2019. This is also from The Guardian. It was about renewing the Lake Victoria ships. Lake Victoria ships renewing to cost $150 billion. That number was listed in Tanzanian shillings, which is about, that would be about $64 million U.S. if my conversion was accurate.
That is not very much money.
It's not
in the grand scheme of things.
In the context of like a national economy, it's a lot, but also it isn't for something that's so integral to your transportation system. So the article highlights the building of a new ship for Lake Victoria with a capacity of 1,200 passengers and 400 tons of cargo. So this is interesting in that you see the listed capacity so much higher than these older vessels. You know, of course, if we know that 1,000 people are going to be on this boat, then let's build a ship that can handle 1,000 people. So in addition to this, major repairs to the Victoria and the Butiama. Both of those ships were ships involved with the rescue of the Bukoba that we talked about. If you remember the MV Victoria from those, keep in mind, the Victoria was first launched in 1959.
So that's an old ship, but I will say being on a freshwater lake, I mean, comparing it to like the Great Lakes freighters that we talk about a lot, not that old. Like you can do that on a, like in a saltwater situation, that's very old, but like there's Great Lakes freighters from the 1920s and 30s that still sail, but the maintenance factor is key there. Like they go through major overhauls and do, you know, do legitimate maintenance.
Right.
You can't have 1959 is very old if you're not taking care of it. So in theory, it would be very serviceable, but it doesn't sound like maintenance and safety are the top priorities here. So it probably needs a lot of work.
Right. So this a final note here from this Guardian article, quote: "The ship is being built in accordance with a promise by former President Benjamin Mkapa, given 23 years ago after the tragedy of the Bukoba in May 1996, now being implemented by President John Magufuli." So we've kind of come full circle in this. And why I wanted to include that last bit is that it kind of shows how this accident that we mainly discussed in the episode, you know, 1996 is a relatively long time ago.
Right.
And the fact that this issue basically still hasn't been resolved. You know, things are still being done, you know, in accordance with things that happened in the aftermath of this accident.
Yeah. It's pretty shocking that this doesn't seem like a hard thing to fix to like us, but there's apparently just no money to do this. I mean, if $64 million can fix all of these safety issues for thousands of people, you know, it just seems like to a lot of Western people, like, why would you not just spend the money?
Yeah, and that was actually something in the 2011 article, the Somava Mitra Guardian article, that he actually mentioned was there is a good amount of discussion about where's this money going? You know, Tanzania is not a massively rich nation, but there's money for this. And so people have asked, you know, where's all this money going? And one answer to that is that the Tanzanian Navy announced it was acquiring automatic identification radar systems to reportedly enhance the fight against illegal fishing and piracy.
Interesting.
So Mava Mitra asks, when money's at a premium, why not care for the safety of law-abiding citizens first, rather than try to catch criminals? Which I think is an interesting point. You know, the United States is no stranger to spending money on fancy military gadgets. But yeah, one has to ask, you know, if our basic infrastructure is failing at such a consistent rate with such high casualties, should we maybe focus on that?
Yeah, that is very interesting. Again, it's not very much money in the grand scheme of things. You're talking about thousands of lives potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thousands of lives. And then also, you know, of course, this, as we saw in as we saw like in the Sewell episode, these things are all interconnected. You know, it's not just a tragedy isolated from other things. You know, this connects with society. This connects with politics. It's probably in the grand scheme of things, a small price to pay for keeping things stable.
Right.
So anyway,
yeah, I think this was a really interesting one.
Yeah, this one was, I had to learn a lot about Tanzania. I still obviously don't know much about Tanzania, but I know a lot more than I did 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. which is always a good thing. And I think that's one of the things I really love about doing the show is that I think each week I'm always having to learn more, not just about the wrecks themselves, but about the context. And yeah, I think that's a really good thing.
Definitely. It's, you know, kind of like summing up this one, I think it's like we always talk about, it's never one thing, and it's the same thing here. It's the overloading, it's the lack of maintenance, you know, it's the lack of safety, you know, protocols and things like that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even appear that there was any attempt to evacuate the vessel. It seems like whatever happened really quickly. So it's never one thing. And unfortunately, when you don't have any of the safety protocols and all that, you're basically asking for something like this to happen. And, you know, if you do it enough, this is going to happen, and it's continued to happen. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like it's an entirely avoidable tragedy, it sounds like, in this case.
Yeah, I think if we made t-shirts for the show, it would just say, it's never just one thing.
One day we'll have that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think I'm glad we did this one. This is a good story. It's one that, it's one of the top 20 probably shipwreck disasters in terms of lives lost, and I didn't know anything about it prior to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was a challenging one to research.
Is there anything else, any other points you have, or anything else you wanted to discuss?
I think that's everything I've got here.
Okay. Cool. Well, we definitely appreciate everybody listening. Get some questions in, like we talked about at the top of the episode. And we look forward to doing this again next week. Thank you, everybody, for listening.